Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Project Tolstoy is complete. Project Tolstoy is complete. You guys should be so excited, right? Are you? You're probably not because you still don't know what Project Tolstoy is, but it is complete. It's entirely edited and proofread and ready to be sent to the publisher. It's even been typeset. Got a little bit more tinkering to do before it's entirely ready to be published. But in terms of the text itself, which you can guess by now, it's probably some kind of book. It's ready. I'm still not ready to tell you guys what it is because I don't want to tell you guys what it is until it's out there, until you can actually like follow a link and see what I'm talking about. So, just building the hype train. But I'll have you guys know, it's ready for consumption. It just needs to be put out there into the world, which is, well, I'm short of breath. Sorry, I just had a really quick shower and rushing around getting ready to actually go out and watch a comedy show. And I'm like, oh, before I do the comedy show, I'm going to do the podcast so I don't have to do it later on. So I was just rushing. That's why I'm out of breath. Also because I'm very unhealthy. Anyway, as I was saying, let me just catch my breath here. Project Tolstoy will be ready very, very soon. I would be putting it out there into the stores tonight if I wasn't going out to this show. I might even come home and do it later tonight. If not, it'll be tomorrow, some point over this weekend, and very soon I'll have something awesome for you guys to check out. All right, now, oh dear, I've done the thing. You know that thing that I do sometimes? You know the one? Yep. We are talking about Anna Karenina, Part 1, Chapter 11. Quite a few relatable sentiments in this chapter. Did you have any some things never change moments? Do you have a friend, or are you maybe the friend, who is who demands too great a mental and spiritual strain, and how do you like Levin's chances? Eula is a pimp said, there was a lot of sadness embedded in this chapter to me. Two people trying, or maybe not, but who should, to connect with each other, but not getting there. And suddenly both of them felt that though they were friends, though they had been dining and drinking together, which should have drawn them closer, yet each was thinking only his own affairs, and they had nothing to do with one another. Yeah, I mean, I didn't think that was sad. I just thought it was very real. But if you're close enough friends, that doesn't really bother you, right? I've got friends where we talk to each other, neither of us need to listen to each other. We just think it's amusing. We call it everyone talking, no one listening. Although my read from last chapter was that Levin's troubles were really just too depressing for Oblonsky, who has other things he'd rather be talking about, which I think is hinted at again here. And at once, in the conversation with the aide-de-camp, Oblonsky had a sense of relaxation and relief after the conversation with Levin, which always put him to too great a mental and spiritual strain. I've got friends, and I think I am that friend for other people, who, when you meet with them and have a catch-up, it's too big. It's not just small talk or chit-chat. It's like big, deep conversations with epiphanies or like, I don't know. It's like you feel like you walk away from the conversation with new homework about, you know, getting your life in order sort of thing. Or you're extremely inspired and motivated to go and do this thing. And which is a great feeling, right? It is a great feeling to feel motivated and inspired. But also, when there's someone who every time you talk to them, you leave feeling motivated and inspired, it can actually be a bit exhausting. Because it's like, oh, you know what? I've kind of got enough on my plate. I don't need to be inspired to do some huge new chapter of my life when I'm actually still midway through the previous one. So I do have friends where it's like, oh, I love that guy, I love hanging out with him, but man, I don't think I'm in the right place to go another round of that big think that they are so accustomed to. And I think also for a few people, I am that person. To me, the most interesting part of the chapter, says Eula as a pimp, is the moral question which Oblonsky puts forward speaking of his mistress. Yes, but joking apart, resumed Stepan Arkadyevich, You must understand that the woman is a sweet, gentle, loving creature, poor and lonely, and has sacrificed everything. Now, when the thing's done, don't you see? Can one possibly cast her off? Even supposing one parts from her, so as not to break up one's family life, still, can one help feeling for her, setting her on her feet, softening her lot? The act of cheating on his wife was morally debased. However, does he not, after the fact, still carry some moral responsibility to provide for the mistress, who will suffer her own consequences due to the affair? Even if it detracts from his wife and his family, it is a complicated situation with no clear answer to me. And the biggest question, does Oblonsky actually care about this issue? Or is he just looking for an excuse to continue to associate with his fling? Actually, the episode of Sopranos that I watched very recently about him trying to dump his mistress. And that sense of responsibility where his mistress, you know, she doesn't get to live in his big fancy house or anything like that. And without him, she says something like, I'll have to be a stripper, and then once I get too old for that, I'll have to be a prostitute, and she doesn't want to have to do these things. And he feels this responsibility for her, and he gives her $75,000. So, you know, the Sopranos might hold the answer. I don't think that's what Oblonsky will do, but anyway. Maiev said, as you said, it's hard to know if Oblonsky is being sincere about wanting to provide for his mistress, but considering that he owes money all over town, it's hard to see how he could pull that off. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong, but I haven't gotten the impression that Dolly is the one with the money. And that she controls the purse strings. Yep. That was the feeling I started to get as well. Especially with that whole Forrest thing where... he needs money, so he's got to convince her, oh, geez, we're going to have to sell off one of these forests, or whatever it was, or something like that. Dr. Nature 96 said, yes, except that in this scenario, Levin, the man, loves his wife. He's keeping the truth of this part a secret from Levin. What was the question? The relatable sentiments. Did you have any some things never change moments? Okay. Question two was, do you have a friend or maybe other friend who demands too great a spiritual and mental strain? I have managed to avoid these friends. The thing is, spiritual strain is something else. In this chapter alone, spiritual and soul are mentioned. Not the norm for me. We normally say my heart or my brain can't take this. Soul and spirit are much deeper. I wonder why Tolstoy goes to that extent. Poor Levin. I think he has a low chance. That guy might be the one Kitty likes. Techrific has offered his unfiltered thoughts. Remember when Levin was thinking about the futility of him pursuing Kitty? How unaccomplished he was, etc. He proceeded to mentally go through a list of attributes and accomplishments he didn't possess and was afraid would count against him in Kitty's eyes, and now he learns of Vronsky, a rival for Kitty's affections, and Steva basically proceeds to list off all the same things. Apparently, Vronsky is and has all those qualities and accomplishments to his name. He is terribly rich, and he's a soldier, an aide-de-camp, in fact, a decent, educated, well, Levin is educated too, but still. And Vronsky is clever. Poor Levin, the odds are stacked against him. We are 45 pages in and Anna is nowhere to be seen. Anyone else wondering when she's going to show up? They sure talk a lot, but what are they talking about exactly? It seems Steva is thinking a lot about and defending family values until he remembers that he basically stamped on those values himself whilst philandering. So here's an example of personal beliefs and values in conflict with his own behaviour. There's a disconnect between his values and his actions. Steva tries to defend his actions to himself by labeling them as something frivolous or trivial in the name of having a good time, living with the compass needle set to pleasure. A note to Ander. Hey, that's me. No, peasant with a personality in war and peace, have you already forgotten Pierre's fellow prisoner who taught him the value of a potato? Ah, yeah, good point. I do remember him, although I don't remember his name. And... you don't seem to either. that's a good point, though. He was a very valuable character in the book. That guy was dirt poor and a peasant drafted to the war machine. His philosophy of life was one of the most memorable things in the book. Rant over. Yep, you got me. There is one peasant. There's probably quite a few peasants. I think there's also Tikhon is old man Bolkonski's servant. Mademoiselle Bourienne is her, like Princess Maya's, I think they called her her, what was it? Not friend, like something. Anyway, so there are some on the lower rungs who are like servants or that kind of thing. But there's also a hell of a lot of peasants and servants and footmen and coachmen who are just in the book, like hundreds of them, hundreds of them. You know, all these different people have their own footmen and servants and cooks and stuff like this. And they're just kind of faceless. Faceless. They're kind of not even human. They're just footmen. And they're all throughout the book, like every scene in the book, there's a footman standing in the background just ready to help them put a jacket on or something like that. But nope, you did get me. You did get me. The fellow prisoner of Pierre who taught him about potatoes. I Am Norwegian said, since the poem made even Levin smirk, I felt compelled to find a translation of it. It is heavenly when I overcome my earthly desires, but nevertheless, when I am not successful, it can also be quite pleasurable. I think I read that translation. I must have been in the footnote of the chapter. It was a good poem. Quite funny. A really fitting poem, says I Am Norwegian, to Stepan's personality. Levin can't catch a break. First, Kitty thinks of him as a brother, and now he's going up against a guy that is everything Levin is not. Little Birdie said, Tolstoy's struggle against emotional and moral complexities is seen in this conversation between Oblinsky and Levin. The struggling philosophy is that such complexities should not be indulged in for life. That's why Levin can't understand Oblonsky's infidelity. To him, it's like, after having eaten a good dinner, now I were to go to the baker's shop and steal a roll. Why succumb to unnecessary temptations and sacrifice one's morality for pleasure? Why commit the figurative theft of one's love and honour when one is already happy and has what one needs? Thus the philosophy, don't steal rolls. I thought that bit was kind of funny. But also, why is he stealing the rolls? Why isn't it like, after having a lovely dinner, someone gives you a delicious, fresh, buttered roll? And even though you're not hungry, it's still, you kind of want that delicious roll. Swim said, the mama fishy said, Levin can certainly come off as a bit of a prig. Prig. A self-righteous, moralistic person who behaves as if superior to others.
Prig.
Control 6156 says, this chapter really made me yuck with Stephen, and then Levin smirking about it. Is that Stephen's charm or his deep down agreement? Super yuck. Yes, cheaters try to rationalize their cheating. That is certainly part of humans. Friendships and relationships are so complex. There are always people that lean on their friends too much, and there are some people who have a very low tolerance of how much stain they can help their friends bear. This conversation seems very much like two people talking to each other about their problems with neither really listening to the other. Levin, sorry bro, you don't stand a chance. He's got the mum on his side. Even if there was no other suitor for Kitty, that relationship would never work. She's not into it, and you put her on such a pedestal that reality could never live up to your expectations. Yeah, that sounds like, that sounds about right. Once they're on the pedestal, yeah, you've created quite a divide between you. They can't help but look down at you from there. Guanaro said, Levin's Madonna versus whore mentality is in regards to women really grossed me out this chapter, especially since his judgment of the French girl seemed to be based purely on appearance. I thought he was a nice guy up until now, but I am concerned he will become more of a quote-unquote nice guy. Al Treat said, yep. Got vibes of this too. Nice guy Levin seems like it's a thing. Talking about how fallen women are vermin. Yuck. So the governess is vermin for falling prey to Oblonsky, but Stepan's A-OK because even though he's the one with the wife and children, the age and the power differential on his side. Our Treat also said, how do you like Levin's chance as well? Now that Vronsky's on the scene, I think they are diminished. But I also thought it would be interesting if he did marry Kitty, and because she wasn't that into him, she cheated on him, thus becoming one of the vermin he speaks so strongly against. Perhaps a little vindictive of me, but he is passing such a black and white judgment on other people's choices when he really knows very little about them was off-putting. Yeah, in a modern context, it's super off-putting. I mean, even then, you know, probably pretty unjustified. But there was that real thing about, like, purity, you know, the purity of your partner. And I think guys just could not get their head around the fact that the people they love might have previously loved other people. Yeah, different times, hey? Different times. I think that opinion that he's given, that nice guy opinion about, oh, you know, if she's slept around, she's vermin, it wouldn't have been that frowned upon to just say something like that back then, which is just so weird to try to put into a modern context. I suppose the only thing you can really say to justify it is you would hope that this is kind of like talk that they wouldn't ever say to those people. But you know, when you talk about someone else behind their back, knowing that that person can never hear what you're going to say and it won't actually affect them, sometimes you can be way more harsh than you would ever be to them. Is that a saving grace? Not really. He's still saying these horrible things, but I would like to think that he would never actually say anything like that to the person. Just, you know, just safely behind their back. Anyway, let's read chapter 12 of Anna Karenina. Chapter 12 goes like this. Princess Kitty Shcherbatskaya was 18, and this was her first season. Her success in society was greater than that of her two elder sisters, and greater even than her mother had expected. Not only were nearly all the youths that danced at the Moscow balls in love with Kitty, but two serious suitors presented themselves for her that very first winter. Levin, and immediately after his departure, Count Vronsky. Oh, this guy's got Count in his name. Come on. Levin doesn't stand a chance. Levin's arrival at the beginning of the winter, his frequent visits and evident love for Kitty gave rise to her parents' first serious deliberation as to her future and to dispute between them. The prince took Levin's part and said he desired nothing better for Kitty. The princess, with a woman's way of talking around the question, said that Kitty was too young, that Levin had not shown that his intentions were serious, that Kitty was not in love with him, and so on, but she did not say the most important things, namely, that she expected a better match for her daughter, that she did not like Levin and did not understand him. When he suddenly left, the princess was pleased and triumphantly said to her husband, "You see, I was right." When Vronsky appeared, she was still more pleased and was strengthened in her opinion that Kitty ought to make not only a good but a brilliant match. In the mother's eyes, there was no comparison between Levin and Vronsky. She did not like Levin's strange and harsh criticisms, his awkward manner in society, which she attributed to pride, and what she considered his strange way of life in the country, occupied with cattle and peasants. In particular, she did not like the fact that when he was in love with her daughter, he came to the house for 6 weeks, as if waiting and looking out for something, afraid of doing them too great an honour by making an offer of marriage, and that he did not understand that if he visited a house where there was a marriageable girl, he ought to declare his intentions. And then suddenly he left, without proposing. It's a good thing he is so unattractive and that Kitty has not fallen in love with him, thought her mother. Vronsky satisfied all the mother's desires. He was very rich, clever, distinguished, with a brilliant military career before him, a position at court, and altogether was an enchanting man. Nothing better could be desired. Vronsky was openly attentive to Kitty. When they met at balls and danced with her and came to the house, so there could be no doubt as to the seriousness of his intentions, but in spite of this the mother was in dreadful state of anxiety and agitation all that winter. When the princess herself had married, more than 30 years before, the match had been arranged by her aunt, her fiancé, about whom everything was known beforehand, came, saw his intended bride, and was seen by her people. Then the matchmaking aunt learnt that what was thought of on each side, and passed on the information. All was satisfactory. Afterwards, at an appointed time and place, the expected proposal was made to and accepted by her parents. Everything was done very easily and simply, at least so it seemed to the princess. But in her daughter's case, she experienced how far from easy and simple the apparently easy business of marrying off a daughter really was. What anxiety she had to suffer, how many questions to consider over and over again, how much money to spend, how many encounters with her husband to go through. When her two elder daughters, Daya and Natalie, were married, now that her youngest daughter had come out, she was living through the same fears and doubts and having even worse disputes with her husband than on her elder daughter's account. Like all fathers, the old prince was extremely punctilious where his daughter's purity and honour were concerned. He was unreasonably jealous, especially about Kitty, his favourite, and at every step reproached the princess with compromising her daughter. The princess had grown used to this in respect to her elder daughters, but now she felt that her husband's punctiliousness had more justification. She could see that lately social customs had changed very much, and a mother's duties had become still more difficult. She knew that girls of Kitty's age formed societies of some sort, went to courses of lectures, made friends freely with men, and drove alone through the streets. Many no longer curtsied, and above all, every one of them was firmly convinced that the choice of a husband was her own and not her parents' business. "Nowadays they don't give us away in marriage as they used to," said these young girls, and even the old people said the same. But how marriages are now arranged, the princess could not find out from anyone. The French way of parents deciding a daughter's fate was not accepted, and was even condemned. The English way of giving a girl perfect freedom was also rejected, and would have been impossible in Russian society. The Russian way of employing a professional matchmaker was considered monstrous and was laughed at by everybody, including the princess herself. But how a girl was to get married, or how a mother was to get a daughter given in marriage, no one knew. Everyone with whom the princess discussed the subject said the same thing. "Well, you know, in our days it is time to give up obsolete customs. After all, it's the young people who marry and not their parents. Therefore, they must be left to arrange matters as they think best." It was all very well for people who had no daughters to talk like that, but the princess knew that intimacy might be followed by love, and that her daughter might fall in love with someone who had no intention of marrying her or was not fit to be her husband. And whatever people might say about the time having come when young people must arrange their future for themselves, she could not believe it any more than she could believe that loaded pistols could ever be the best toys for 5-year-old children. That is why the princess was more anxious about Kitty than she had been about her elder daughters. And now she was afraid that Vronsky might content himself with merely flirting with her daughter. She saw that Kitty was in love with him, but consoled herself with the thought that Vronsky was an honest man and therefore would not act in such a way. At the same time, she knew that the freedom now permitted made it easy for a man to turn a girl's head, and knew how lightly men regarded an offence of that kind. The week before, Kitty had repeated to her mother a conversation she had had with Vronsky while dancing the mazurka with him. The conversation had partly reassured the princess, but she could not feel quite at ease. Vronsky had told Kitty that he and his brother were so used to comply with their mother's wishes that they never made up their minds to take an important step without consulting her. "And I am now especially happy looking forward to my mother's arrival from Petersburg," he had said. Kitty had narrated this without attaching any special meaning to the words, but to the mother they appeared in a different light. She knew that the old lady was expected any day and would approve of her son's choice, and though she thought it strange that he should delay proposing for fear of hurting his mother, she so desired the marriage, and especially relief from her own anxiety, that she believed it. Hard as it was to see the misfortune of Dolly, her eldest daughter, who thought of leaving her husband, the princess's anxiety as to her youngest daughter's fate, now about to be decided, entirely absorbed her. Levin's arrival that day gave her further cause for anxiety. She was afraid that her daughter, who had once seemed to have a certain affection for Levin, might be led by an exaggerated feeling of loyalty to reject Vronsky, and she feared that in general Levin's arrival might cause complications and delays in matters now so near conclusion. "Has he been back long?" asked the princess when they got home, referring to Levin. "He arrived today, Mama." "There is one thing I want to say," the princess began, and from her serious look Kitty guessed what was coming. "Mama," she said, flushing and turning quickly toward her mother, "please, please say nothing about it. I know quite well." Her wish was the same as her mother's, but the motive underlying her mother's wish offended her. "I wish to say that having given hopes to one..." "Mama, dearest, for heaven's sake, don't speak. It is so dreadful to speak about it." "I won't. Only this, my darling," said the mother, seeing tears in her daughter's eyes. "You promised not to have any secrets from me, and you won't, will you?" "Never, Mama, never at all," answered Kitty, blushing as she looked her mother straight in the face. "But I have nothing to say at present. If I wished to, I should not know what to say or how. I don't know." No, she could not possibly tell an untruth with such eyes, thought the mother, smiling at her agitation and joy. The princess smiled to think how immense and important what was going on in her own soul must appear to the poor girl. All right, there we go, another chapter. I love that last line. The princess smiled to think how immense and important what was going on in her own soul must appear to the poor girl. Isn't that just a summary of that age? 18, that Romeo and Juliet feeling of the things I'm feeling. I'm sure no one's ever felt love the way I'm feeling it. Or this is the most important thing in the universe, because how could it not be the way I'm feeling about it? Very egocentric time. Alright, have your say about this chapter over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Support the podcast if you want to do that at patreon.com/thehemingwaylist. Is that, did I say that right? Probably, who cares? You know what to do. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.